Kia ora tātou. Great to see so many of you here today. Welcome. Change in format today. Change is as good as a rest, as they say. But it's great to see a good attendance today. So thanks very much for coming along. When we put the program together last year for 2025, we thought we'd concentrate on anniversaries and commemorations. And I know I mention this every week or every time we get together. But I think it's important to select appropriate commemorations, particularly significant anniversaries. And so this year we're looking at the 110th anniversary of the Gallipoli landings. But to put it into context, we thought we would start with a topic that we have today, and that is the defeat of the Allied fleet in the Dardanelles. And once again, we've got our resident naval expert, retired Commander Richard Jackson, who's come across from the Wairarapa today to tell us a little bit more about that particular aspect. If you have friends who couldn't get here to the presentation today, we actually record the presentation and we take the PowerPoint and the audio recording and we actually upload it on our website. And the URL links for those websites are on the back of on the brochures, just at the back there, next to the donations box. So, without further ado, please welcome Richard.
Kia ora katoa. Lovely to see you all and a full house. I'm privileged and challenged to make this worthwhile. As you can see, the title is about the Allied naval assault on March the 18th of 1915. But in the nature of any military action, it all evolves out of a series of political and strategic decisions. So we'll be talking about, firstly, the escape of the German Mediterranean Squadron to Turkey, and bear in mind, I'll be using the word Ottoman Empire and Turkey rather interchangeably, but it was strictly the Ottoman Empire. The British annoy the Turks by requisitioning battleships. The Ottoman Empire goes to war, courtesy of some German manipulation. And then while the strategic situation across Europe is unfolding at a rate of knots, with the onset of World War I, the Allied commanders in the Mediterranean kind of spoil the surprise they might well have otherwise achieved, which becomes a bit of a factor. So, the world in 1914, and in the browny goldy colour is the Triple Alliance, and one point to note is that Italy is a member of the Triple Alliance, the Ottoman Empire is not, but Italy, when the crunch comes in August 1914, decides to stay neutral. So that led me down a little bit of a rabbit hole of just when did every nation decide to join in World War I? It didn't have some great single moment. And as you can see for Europe, it's all the way through to 1916 before the last couple of nations join in. Greece, when it does join in March 1915, simply allows the Allies to use Greek territory, which is awfully helpful for the subsequent Gallipoli campaign. And between Germany, Russia, France and Britain, there's a sort of cascading sequence of events, and that becomes important because the German Mediterranean Squadron is based up with the Austrian fleet at the north of the Adriatic Sea. Shall we just go back and highlight? So the Austro-Hungarian Empire reaches the Adriatic Sea, and they have their own navy. Goeben is a very modern, fast battle cruiser, and she's supported by a little light cruiser as well. And the danger is that Goeben will be sent to attack French troop ships, taking French troops from Algeria, a French colony, to metropolitan France. So the British Admiralty and the British Naval Commander in the Mediterranean are focused on protecting French troops going to France, even though Britain has not yet declared war. Now, as it happens, Girvan and the light cruiser do attack the French ports in Algeria. They don't meet any of the troop ships. And they then start heading east towards Turkey. Every ship at this time is worried about coal, and getting fuel supplies for coal is important. Italy is neutral. So the German squadron refuels at Messina in Sicily, and the British position their ships in the wrong place, and war has not yet been declared. So the British ships that could meet the Girvan are on the western end of Sicily, and on the eastern end of Sicily is a Admiral Trowbridge's squadron with four of these older style armoured cruisers. And when war is declared on the evening of the 4th of August, Trowbridge's squadron is the only one in position to intercept the German ships. And because Churchill had issued an order to not get engaged with a superior squadron, meaning the Austro-Hungarian fleet, Trowbridge is a bit uncertain. His ship's not as fast as the Girvan, his guns are shorter range than the Girvan. He does have four of these ships, but as dawn breaks on, I think it's the 7th of August, when he's finally caught up with the Girvan, he breaks off the engagement and never actually fires on the ship. Now, the sequence of events, this is a rather poor map, but so Girvan starts up here, comes down to Sicily, which is neutral, has a go at the French. The British are still not in the war, but they're tailing the German squadron. And then after refueling again at Messina, the British expect him to go west, but in fact he goes east, and Trowbridge's squadron comes up to intercept him, and the Admiral chooses not to. Girvan gets away and under orders goes through the Dardanelles to Turkey. So firstly, it's an aspect of huge embarrassment for the Royal Navy, and still is. And secondly, Girvan and the light cruiser suddenly become part of the Turkish Navy. The British, in the meantime, even as war is may or may not be breaking out, 2nd of August, they have two big battleships under construction for the Turkish Navy, and they requisition them for the Grand Fleet. Now, given that the ships have been built in part by a popular subscription of money from the enthusiastic Turkish people, there was great annoyance when these ships were requisitioned. It's hard to imagine. Can you think of the government saying to us, look, we're going to need more ships, please put your money in your pocket, put your hands in your pocket and start making donations or holding cake sales for our next frigate. I think it's hard to imagine this, but the Turks are very proud of their ships. One of them became HMS Agincourt, the other, as you saw, HMS Erin, served in the Grand Fleet. Agincourt is a bit interesting because she has seven twin turrets of 12-inch guns, the most gun turrets on any of the modern era dreadnoughts, and incidentally in Royal Navy service the turrets were listed as Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And in the meantime, the Turkish flag is flown from the Girvan, which becomes Yavuz Sultan Selim, and Breslau gets the name of Medili. They still have their German crews. Now, the importance here, of course, is the Dardanelles control access to the Black Sea. And the Black Sea is where Russia has its southern coast, and you're familiar from current events in the Ukraine war with the geography there. The Black Sea is also the recipient of various rivers, the giant rivers in Russia, the Volga, etc. So there is a current running through the Dardanelles and through the straits. Where are they? So from here, past Constantinople, and then the Dardanelles themselves. So the current is always flowing out to the Mediterranean. Mediterranean that does not have significant tides. And just as a reminder, there's a little spot here which was known as the Golfer's Alexandretta. So over on the left where the geography of the Mediterranean turns south. And this was a bit of a vulnerable point for the Ottoman Empire because of the railways running from Turkey through to Palestine and on to Sinai and the Turkish-controlled area there. So HMS Philomel, our only available ship at the time, had deployed all the way to the Mediterranean and in company with other British cruisers of the same type, spent several weeks in the beginning of 1915 trying to interdict the Turkish railways that ran past that bottleneck of Alexandretta down through Syria, etc. So that's really the only New Zealand connection that we have at this time. But it is noteworthy that World War I breaks out, and what do? We deploy our ship all the way to the Mediterranean. Now, the Ottoman Empire, of course, goes to war. It goes to war through courtesy of some German subterfuge by the German ships attack the Russians. But very suddenly, 5th of November, when the war is declared with the British Empire and the French, a lot of things happen at once. The British Indian Army goes into the Persian Gulf to protect the oil fields. If you remember, it was Churchill who had signed an agreement with the Anglo-Persian Oil Company to have oil for the fleet. That oil company now subsequently became BP. And so the British had to protect it, and that was the responsibility of the Indian Army. The Ottomans themselves prepared to attack Egypt and close the Suez Canal. And you may recall that was to Egypt that our first convoy of troops went with the Australians. And at the same time, the most important thing from the Turkish point of view is that they were engaged in a campaign against the Russians on the eastern end of Turkey at the Caucasus Mountains. And that went well for the Turks, which caused the Russians to ask the British and French for help. And so how could they help? They could help by attacking the Dardanelles. That was the basic concept. Now, this particular map covers the whole campaign, but for our purposes, we're interested in the forts that are here at the tip of the Gallipoli Peninsula, similar forts down here on the Asiatic shore, more forts, lots of minefields in here. But this is deep water, fair bit of room to move until you get to the narrows. So it's a bit of a challenge for naval planning. The Brits and the French, however, throw away any chance of surprise. So basically, at the time that war is declared, in fact, shortly before, the British and French attack the forts at the tip of the Gallipoli Peninsula. They try again on the 25th of February 1915. This time they're more successful, damage to the forts, and indeed, as I'll show you, they land Royal Marines into the damaged, destroyed forts at the tip of the peninsula. And they have another go on the 1st of March, and they are aware of the minefields, and so they're looking for a way to sweep the mines so that the ships can get through. But the mines, of course, are guarded by all their gun batteries. And so even as late as the 13th of March, they have a night effort to sweep the mines, which goes badly because the Turks switch on their searchlights and promptly shell the covering British ship. And this is what one artist renders the older style battleships attacking the forts on the Gallipoli Peninsula. So it's worth talking about the Turkish forts. They've been there since the 19th century. Some of them were older than that, but they have been modernised because of the various Balkan wars in the 1910-1912 time frame. and they had gone, the Turkish army, who were great admirers of the German army, had gone to the Krupp works to get modern guns to supplement the older style cannons that they had in the forts. And so the points here are the forts at the tip, as we've discussed, which were the forts that the Allied fleet had pretty much neutralised, forts on both sides of the Narrows, the headquarters at Kanakale, and 10 lines of mines in the Narrows. And so this is what one of them looks like, obviously on parade order, an inspection about to occur. I believe that's one of the Krupp 240mm, that's 9.5-inch guns, visible. And here are the Royal Marines on the 25th of February at one of the destroyed gun sites on the fort at the tip of the Dardanelles. And this is one of the older style forts, as you can see, a sort of castle-type structure, but modern gun positions here covering the straits. And one of the forts, I think the same one today, as a memorial, historic site. And I've said about the Allied fleet spoiling surprise. The other thing that happened was that Allied submariners wanted to get through the straits. Much more demanding. 10 minefields, remember? And so on the 13th of December, one submarine has a go, a B-class submarine, which had incidentally petrol, not diesel engines. A French submarine had a go, and slightly outside of our particular timeline, but on the night of the Anzac landings, the Australian submarine, AE2, successfully gets through the straits and has some success. But of course doesn't come back. Subsequently, throughout the whole Gallipoli campaign, 6 other submarines had a go at penetrating the straits, similarly without any great luck of surviving. The point is, surprise is given away, and these are some of the commanders responsible. Roger Keyes was a... Roger Keyes here was a young commodore, a bit of a favourite of Churchill's. Admiral de Robeck was a very straightforward and conventional British naval officer. And the two generals, General Ian Hamilton, of course, oversaw the subsequent troop campaign. So here's a rather nice artist's rendition of the battleship Queen Elizabeth joining the British force. Queen Elizabeth had 15-inch guns, the biggest in the world, and Churchill was confident that they were sort of the secret weapon of the time, and so along with the other ships, which tended to have 12-inch guns, Queen Elizabeth was going to be the answer to any Turkish fortification. But of course he didn't want her lost, she was brand new. So this looks a bit boring, and it also gives away the results. This is the lineup. The decision for the 18th of March, having had all these smaller scale surprise giving away shorter attempts, this was going to be the major attempt. And they have what adds up to, 14 battleships of various kinds, French and British. Queen Elizabeth, the newest, most powerful. 2 ships here, Inflexible, was a battle cruiser, also new and impressive, should have been one of the ships that found the Goeben but didn't. The French ships tended to be older, but nonetheless armoured and carrying 12-inch guns or thereabouts in size. So this is an extraordinarily powerful fleet for its time, and they're lined up essentially in parade ground order to sail into the wide part of the straits and just going slowly ahead, bombard the forts, the main forts with their main armament, anything else they would have a go at with their secondary armament. And so lines of battleships sailing up, they were not going up to the minefields, they were to cover minesweepers. And this is one artist's rendition showing several of the French ships. And this is what an actual photograph looks like, much more widely dispersed. And this is a typical of the pre-dreadnought type battleships. And a couple of the French ships, you'll notice on this one, the French designers had what's called tumble home to an extraordinary extent. Not that it was supposed to be a sea-keeping stability system, but it wasn't all that successful, but they made for rather ugly ships. Oops. And a photograph taken on HMS Agamemnon, apparently on the day. Now, a couple of things. Sailors are in their whites. It is the Mediterranean, and it's tropical, but not a very practical rig for working guns and grease and oil and all the mechanism of heavy gunfire. They also don't have what we would wear today, anti-flash gear. Anti-flash gear was a balaclava covering and big gauntlets on your sleeves, and that came into that was suddenly invented as a result of the Battle of Jutland. So this is definitely a 1915-era photo. And an artist's impression of the battlecruiser, inflexible, taking some hits, but firing as well. Now, so we're in the middle of March the 18th. It's midday, and the fleet have gone into the straits, and they're engaging the forts with heavy naval gunfire. A continual roar of main guns, secondary armament, and attempting to spot how much damage you've done. It's a dynamic, dramatic, noisy process. The night before, this little Turkish mine layer had set out. And she laid us a row of 20 mines, but in a spot that the British didn't expect, nor the French. What they had seen on the previous occasions was that as the British ships sailed into that big bay, they tended out of habit to turn to starboard and approach the Asiatic shore and then sail out of the straits. So that's where the minefield was laid. And that's this minefield number 11 here. So the main fleet is occupying here, engaging with gunfire the forts, and when it says time that the front rank should turn right and allow the second rank to move forward of these battleships, they turn right and into the minefield. So the first one to hit a mine was the French battleship Bouvet, sank very quickly, massive losses, and it was assumed by those in command it was a magazine explosion. They didn't think of a minefield. And so Bouvet is sunk just on 2 o'clock. It's a couple more hours before Inflexible is going to withdraw, and she hits a mine. And soon after that, about an hour after that, the battleship Irresistible turns into the minefield and hits a mine. And stupidly, another battleship is ordered to help the Irresistible, and it too, of course, hits a mine. So here's an actual photo of Bouvet listing heavily and about to sink. And this is Irresistible. She had hit the mine, had time for the crew to abandon ship and be taken off, and was left drifting. And HMS Ocean was sent to try and take it under tow, hits another mine, and is left in pretty much the same state. So suddenly the whole day of battle is brought to a halt by these ships being sunk by this unexpected minefield. And the Allied command thinks, what should they do? If Churchill had had some young, thrusting officers, they might well have said, well, these are mostly second-rate battleships. We'd rather get through the straits with some casualties than not succeed. But in fact, de Robeck and his French counterpart were conventional thinkers. We're losing ships. It's been peacetime, after all, for umpteen years. You don't lose ships. We know with the Manawanui. And so these sudden series of ships being mined shakes their confidence, and they withdraw the fleet. So what's happening in the meantime is, firstly, that the Ottomans, the Turkish, have relatively light casualties ashore, and they've successfully sunk battleships and damaged a number of the other ships. In Constantinople, the US ambassador notes that there's panic occurring, and they're preparing to evacuate the city, and he thinks if the British continue the attack the next day, they will evacuate Constantinople and probably surrender to the Brits. And Commodore Roger Keyes, who you saw the photograph of, the young officer, he's on a destroyer that goes into the Straits after dark to look for the Irresistible and the Ocean, which of course have sunk. And so he feels that they had beaten the foe. He felt it in mid-afternoon, that the gunfire was wearing down the forts, and even at night, when he went in to look for the sunken ships, he still felt that all was good and that they could succeed. None of us, have, of course, had addressed the mines, because the minesweepers had failed. And so what we do know is, in fact, there was still lots of ammunition in the forts. That's estimated they could have had another 2 days' worth of fighting. The other guns further up the Narrows had not yet been involved in the fighting. They're the ones covering the minesweepers, covering the minefields. And that they, in fact, could have come into action very successfully at the Narrows against the ships. Churchill, however, was full of aggression and wanted to press on. De Robic thought he would do a bit more staff work and get organised. And the crews from the sunken battleships were reassigned to the minesweepers on the grounds that they would be a bit more aggressive about minesweeping. And all this was going on, and at the same time the British and French armies were realising that, in fact, the right answer is to land troops. And so the decision was taken in at the end of March that they would pause, organise their troops, and they would come in next month and land. So that's this, incidentally, a modern photograph, one of the Krupp guns that's at a Turkish museum in the Dardanelles. It may not show up here, but the tip of the barrel has actually been blown off, so it was one of the guns damaged on the day. So in summary, we've had that, 14 battleships go against the forts, possibly successfully, but were let down because the minesweeping effort completely failed. And ironically, in February, when the British attacked the forts at the tip of Gallipoli and landed the Royal Marine, that was the answer, a combined operation aimed at the forts, cover from the heavy ships, and land an appropriate landing force to take possession of the peninsula. That was all there on the 25th of February, but that had not been agreed by those in authority. All they did then was give away surprise. The 18th of March confirmed that the British were and French were indeed serious about attacking the Ottomans, the Turks, at Gallipoli. So, of course, the Turkish staff work was to, in fact, reinforce the Gallipoli Peninsula. Both sides could see what needed to happen. Both sides took the necessary precautions, and we all know what happened on the 25th of April and afterwards. So the great naval assault of the 18th of March was a unique event. Ships against forts. The strategic purpose was to support Russia. They were under pressure from the Russians. There was an appropriate logic to the strategic vision, but in fact the way they carried it out turned it into the complete and utter failure that we sadly still remember today. So the 18th of March was an important precursor to the Gallipoli campaign, important because it failed, and it failed for a number of reasons, but mostly I would say because of the lack of ruthlessness of the commanders, the fact they gave away any chance of surprise, and the fact that they didn't, of course, think in combined operation terms. That's my korero.
Thank you, Richard. That's enabled us a bit of time for discussion and questions. So, questions? Yeah?
If take invasion of Gallipoli, Anzac Cove, Plan B, and the attack on the Dardanelles, Plan A, if that part of Plan A had been successful, what's the next step?
I think the next step was an expectation that they could occupy Constantinople as an open city, that the Turkish government would have either evacuated or had openly surrendered to the Allies. If they could get their fleet off Constantinople and threaten it, and given what the US ambassador observed, that could therefore have meant that the Ottoman Empire stepped out of the war, and at the very best became neutral. And then, of course, reinforcements could flow to the Russians, was the theory. Yeah, so that might have happened, but I think the British, the Allied commanders, were quite unrealistic about the mine threat. Mines were, well, they weren't exactly a new weapon, but this whole war was, you know, lots of new technologies in it, and I think they totally underestimated that. Yeah.
So the 18th of March, the Turks celebrate that every year, probably to more an extent than we commemorate the 25th. In fact, on the hill, Straits, they've got a big sign that says 18th of March, sea from the Dardanelles. And when Charles went there for the 19th celebrations, they wouldn't let his ship sail further up the Dardanelles than they got that day. Taking the shore proved difficult. They really wanted to go ashore directly from the ship. So it's still a very important day for the Turks.
Yes, I understood that it was important for them. I hadn't realised they were that careful about it. Don't bring your British ships up any further.
That sign up on the promontory on the other side, on the European side, you can't miss it. It's huge. Be aware. This is what the commemoration is all about.
Yeah. And I think that when we do have our major commemorations there, there's usually a Turkish ship visible off Anzac Cove, just to remind us that, yes, it's the Turkish Navy that rules the waters. Yeah.
And in fact, I think, that's at the Museum of Kumakawa.
Yeah, I believe that's so, yes.
But also, I think the Nisri, the minesweeper, is still parked on the dock when you go there.
Yes.
And so that minesweeper survived, 110 years, basically, pulled alongside, and you can actually go on board and tour it. So, it's lasted a long time.
Yes.
Yeah. Both at Kumkali and further up, certainly overhead, up the on the Asiatic side of the peninsula. It's true.
Yeah, you said that the Navy should have been more aggressive and carried on, but they hadn't cleared the mines. There was still a lot of guns and ammunition, so what would have happened if they'd done?
Well, it undoubtedly would have been a bloody fight. The key to it was really the effectiveness of the minesweepers, that the minesweepers on the 18th of June of March and before hadn't been effective. The minefields were visible from air reconnaissance. Actually, I hadn't touched on that. HMS Ark Royal, Ark Royal number 2, was there with her float planes, her seaplanes, and they were spotting for mines, but they had never spotted the new row of mines that the Nusret lay. It would have been a bloody day, quite sure, but if they had started to be effective about minesweeping, they may have been more emboldened to make progress.
Is what you're arguing that the from south of the minefields, the fleet could have covered the forts which were covering the minefields so that the mineskippers could then go in? If that makes sense.
Yes, sir. Looking for the nice man.
I think that's that one of the people might want
to. Oh, here we go. I think if it had been a thought-out combined operation, your sort of key points are the fortifications, and so to get close to them, you've got to sweep the mines that are all in this area, and to sweep the mines, you've got to neutralise the shore batteries. And so it's essentially, I would think, a matter of kind of raiding parties going ashore. You certainly couldn't do a full, land a full division with its administrative tail under fire there, but that would have been a necessary part of covering a major landing. This particular map, which is, of course, showing the whole campaign, the British Army strategy was, of course, that it's easy to get across the peninsula, but not so when you've got an alert Turkish army with German officers, etc., lining all those hilltops. So this is for my staff college paper, I would have pointed that the narrows and the various forts on the shore were the sort of centre of gravity that had to be neutralised.
So I think my real question was, what was the range of the 15-inch guns, and so how far away from the forts could they still be and take them out?
On
that map, what's 15 miles on that map?
Yes, well, with the battleship's big guns, the 15-inch of Queen Elizabeth or the 12-inch of the others, yes, you'd get a range of probably 10 to 15 miles, but you've also got to observe the fall of shot, and the fire control systems were dependent very much on visual spotting.
I mean, strategically, there were two other failures. Mm-hmm. The Royal Flying Corps at that stage, eventually the RAF, was at its very embryonic stages, and I mean, whilst Ark Royal 2 did have flying boats and could have and did launch them, the aerial reconnaissance wasn't well controlled. And as Richard said, the joint operations between land, air, and sea just didn't really exist. That was the first point. The second point was aerial reconnaissance and even sea or land or air reconnaissance, it just didn't exist to the same extent that we know today. So all of the maps that were produced, such as they were in those days, were inaccurate, they weren't well thought out, and so all of the planning that the Allied forces did, particularly for the Gallipoli campaign, were all faulted in the fact that they didn't know exactly where they were landing, what they were landing, what they were facing, and there was no aerial reconnaissance to support it, particularly with the amount of Turkish forces that were up, on the other side of the Dardanelles. So, when you look at it from a combined operations point of view and land information, it was a shambles. Sorry, Dennis.
Yeah, it wasn't the Royal Flying Corps, Royal Naval Air Service. But, there was no air-to-ground radio at that stage.
And we were responsible.
You'd have to wait for them to come back and land and then somebody tell the Admiral where the stuff was.
It was also the Royal Engineers too, wasn't it, Michael?
Yeah.
Before it became the Royal Flight Corps along with the Royal Naval Air Service. It was a real mess.
It seems to me there was a huge diplomatic failure at the outset of all this. The Germans were obviously very able to recruit the Turks and form a relationship with them. The British seem to completely deny that opportunity. If they could have had a diplomatic arrangement at the outset, would have avoided all of this. So, I mean, the British seizing the ships that the Turks had come to have been built in Britain, that just added up to a whole lot of dumb diplomacy, as far as I can see.
Well, you're right. Firstly, I understand it, and I didn't dare get into it, that Turkish politics at the time was fairly dynamic, because it appeared that the Germans favoured a particular party within the Turkish political structure, and they were the party that, of course, were enthused about having German advisers come in for the Turkish army. So there was that aspect. But whether the British could have been a bit more focused on their diplomatic things, or were they just taking things for granted because they had kind of ruled the roost for the last 70 or 80 years. And the other point about the two Turkish battleships, Chile had battleships under construction in the UK, and they too were requisitioned. The Royal Navy was very worried about maintaining a superiority over the German high seas fleet, the German dreadnought fleet. The numbers in 1914 were relatively even, and then by the time you take out ships for refit, etc., and the Germans could choose their moment, you could argue that the two fleets could have been quite even had things unfolded. So that's why they were requisitioning the Turkish ships and the Chilean ships as well. The Chileans were a little more agreeable to the whole thing. But in terms of Turkish domestic politics, it really upset a lot of people. Yeah.
Did the British return the guns?
No, they didn't return those particular ships, I think, because...
They were paid for them. Did they return the money?
They were much kinder to the Chileans, who, of course... amongst other things, they had all the nitrates that are needed for explosives. But the Ottoman Empire became an enemy, so there was no question of paying them or saying thank you for your ships.
Yeah.
Of that fleet, how many were dreadnought class and how many oil fired dreadnought, and how many were pre-dreadnought coal fire.
Yeah, in fact, only the two, Queen Elizabeth and Inflexible, were the modern dreadnoughts, and the others were all pre-dreadnoughts. And so, yes, most of them were coal fire. And the French was, they had a relatively second-rate navy at the time. So the key decisions were by the British admirals.
Also think of the strategic implications that had they succeeded in taking Constantinople and put the pressure on the Ottoman Empire, on the Ottoman armies, of how that would have then affected the Sinai campaign and up through from the Suez Canal, Egypt through the Suez Canal and up through Palestine and along that Levant coast of the Mediterranean. I mean, it's the old story of what if.
We wouldn't have needed Lawrence of Arabia.
Well, that's right.
Right.
So, when you think about the sort of strategic goals of the whole thing, that had they resulted either diplomatically, as you're suggesting, or from an armed perspective, what impact that would have had on World War I, it would have certainly shortened World War I significantly, and what would have happened to Germany, had the Ottomans been conquered, taken out a lot earlier. Control of the Suez Canal and the Mediterranean and so on.
The other what if then, therefore, is so if you get through the Straits, you're able to reinforce the Russians, and the Russians have some successful campaigns, there may not have been a Russian revolution.
That's right.
What was the you talked about a couple of submarines. What were they tasked with?
Their goal was to get into the Sea of Sea of Marmara, which is this side of Constantinople and then the Black Sea, that was the Turkish supply route. So Turkish ships were bringing the food, ammunition, reinforcements down to the peninsula through the Sea of Marmara, and if they could start torpedoing some of those ships, that would hamper the Turkish army. That was the intent. Yeah.
That whole, sorry,
was it quite common for torpedoes to malfunction? Because you mentioned there some of the torpedoes didn't work.
Yes. Well, I think, yes, they were a new technology. They were expensive, which is why when you talk about the U-boat campaign, a lot of U-boats would surface and shell merchant ships rather than expend a torpedo. It wasn't uncommon, yeah, although this was obviously noteworthy that with the particular submarine that they obviously had a bad batch. But the things like, you know, gyroscopes and all the mechanical linkages or fuel problems, you know, there are an array of things that could go wrong. Yeah.
Any other questions? Comments?
Yeah, so with the submarines, with the horrendous effort required to get one up there, the last thing you want is that not to work, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Yes.
In fact, yes. I think if you go into Te Manawa, I think Te Manawa has one of the periscope sites off AE1 or AE2. Which in their display, I don't know whether they put it back in the stock, but they had it on display without really understanding the context or the significance of it, and it may still be on display, I don't know. Do you remember, Dennis, we actually had to correct their labelling on that one? No?
Yeah,
you know, yeah, it's 2 or 3 years ago, I remember we corrected them on the ticketing that they had on that particular item. I think it came via Flock House. Some naval collector gave it to Flock House, and Flock House passed it on to the Mull.
But I think it highlights the point that in 1914 there was a slew of new technologies. I mean, automobiles had only been around for barely 14 years. Aircraft were only just lifting off into the sky. We made the point about spotting aircraft. Well, they could either fly with a pilot and observer, or with a pilot and a radio set, but the pilot couldn't operate the radio set because they couldn't carry, they couldn't lift very much, the aircraft of that era. It's a bit different within a couple of years, of course, in the story of World War I, but radios themselves were very new. Name pretty much any technology, and it was not all that old. People were getting used to it, and this was, of course, the first time in a major war that they had to have these things working reliably, and of course they didn't.
Submarine Mining Corps was established back in the 1880s. Again, that was actually run by the engineers. But that was all above surface activity. They didn't really get into underwater stuff until the early 1900s. With all the experimentation that was going on in America with underwater vessels. But all of the other submarine mining activity, which was carried out even here in New Zealand. Wellington Harbour, for example, the engineers mined Wellington Harbour in 1904 during the Russian scare. They had a stock of sea mines down in Kaiforapa, not far from where the railway station is. They actually ran electrically initiated mines right across the Wellington Harbour. So this technology was emerging, but it was taking a heck of a long time to actually get to the point that it is today. So all of this was very experimental, including submarines going underwater.
Yeah, one of the things you have to bear in mind too, that the communication between the ships in that action would generally be by lights or flags, and of course when you start shooting you get lots of smoke and whatever. And you've got two, a French fleet and a British fleet, and well, generally speaking, it's difficult talking to each other.
But don't laugh at the lights and flags, because it's a very good technology. And there's no electronic emissions from it.
Continuing the hypothetical for a second, if they had occupied Istanbul, then I think Churchill's plan was to go up through the Balkans to attack the Austro-Hungarians from the south.
Yeah.
What was the political persuasion of those Serbia and those other countries? Would they have cooperated, or would they have been...
The politics of the Balkans are awful. Romania became an ally, but I think they got overrun or partly overrun by the Germans during World War I. Bulgaria was on the other side. Serbia, of course, had been attacked by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so they were on our side, and they were the ones who, of course, brought Russia into the war. So the Slav linkage here was very important. The Balkans was pretty much a complete mess in those first couple of years of the war. So the politics, it's about the limit of my knowledge.
But it'd be fair to say after they got into Turkey, they didn't have to get through Bulgaria before they got to friendly country.
Yes and no. I mean, you've got to think that this started off 100 years before then. I mean, you know, with the Crimean War back in the early 1800s, the British actually did have a good relationship along here, because they brought in all their supplies up the Danube River. In effect, they had a port, a river authority, which was established here on the Danube Delta, where they brought all of the supplies through to Crimea for the British forces in Crimea at the time. So this has all been going on since, well, in the lead up to 1812, but, you know, 100 years before. So trying to work out the relationships 100 years later has been a real challenge.
So it'd be fair to say that Churchill's overall strategy of the Southern Thrust wasn't totally...
Well, the soft underbelly of...
If you could break through the crust of the Turkey...
It was probably a bold strategy, but the reality is, of course, the Italian experience... up here, where for about 2.5 years they just got thrashed and thrashed and thrashed, and only made progress right in 1918.
I think one thing that a lot of people forget is that there was also a campaign going on in Mesopotamia, the British suffered a defeat there before they really got going.
And that was that's the Persian oil fields. Of which, you know, again, World War One, World War Two was exactly the same scenario, wasn't it?
I'm trying to make that point that once the Ottoman Empire was in, this was a vulnerable point. This was a vulnerable point. The Turks against the Russians, of course. And this was seen as a very appealing shortcut. Mm-hmm. Get to the capital, make them surrender, and you solve all those other problems at once.
And Churchill never forgot it, because he kept talking about the soft underbelly of Europe for the Second World War.
Well,
I think the key there is that they needed the British Navy to keep the supply lines open.
Yeah.
And the British Navy needed Persian oil.
Yes.
And that's the fundamental driver of the whole thing, isn't it?
Especially during the Second World War in particular. But, you know, in the First World War, well, it was all coal-fired as opposed to oil-fired, wasn't it?
Well, all the modern ships. For example, destroyers, the Queen Elizabeth class battleships burned oil, not coal, but every other battleship pretty much burned coal. But every destroyer burned oil, because if you've got a small ship, a small ship's company, you don't have hundreds of men to shovel coal, so the destroyer fleet very quickly went to oil fire. So oil oil fuel for the fleet was important.
Well, my understanding is the power-to-weight ratio of an oil-fired ship is much better than a coal-fired ship, so you get more guns, more ammunition, more armour for the same performance.
All right, well, I think we've probably drawn that one to a conclusion, but I think also we've whetted a little bit of an appetite there. Great discussion, and that's really what we're on about here. So once again, put your hands together. Thank you.